Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This week, we focus on a series of my favorite conversations of 2024. North Carolina native Mary Cardwell Dawson, who founded the nation's first black opera company, never performed in her home state. But acclaimed opera star Denise Graves has appeared in Charlotte many times, and in February she returned to point the spotlight at Dawson. She performed the title role in The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson with Opera Carolina. Dawson's story is as remarkable as Denise Graves' talent, and Graves has made it her mission to tell that story and give her the attention she deserves for starting the National Negro Opera Company in Pittsburgh in 1941, for nurturing hundreds of black artists, for becoming one of the most respected opera singers in history, and for changing the future of opera. We hear more of Mary Cardwell Dawson's story and the musical play that brings it to life as we spend this hour with Denise Graves. Welcome back to Charlotte. Welcome back to the program. Nice to see you again.
Oh, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for having me and for doing this story.
You're welcome. I wish we were in person, but let's start with your foundation, Denise Graves Foundation. Its mission is to promote equity and inclusion in American classical vocal arts by championing the hidden musical figures of the past while uplifting young artists of world-class talent from all backgrounds. Those are your words. It sounds strikingly similar to what Mary Cardwell Dawson was trying to do back in the 40s and 50s.
You know what? I had never put that together in that way. I was so moved, but thank you for that. I was so moved by her story and finding out about her and the work that she's done, and so many others like her, you know, that we created a foundation around this idea of bringing into rightful prominence those great hidden figures, those great hidden musical figures who have been left out of the telling of the American story, and creating works of art that celebrate and share with the public what it is, what their amazing contributions have been that have contributed to our cultural fabric. So I'm delighted and incredibly honored and grateful also to Opera Carolina. James Mina has been so wonderful the entire time. He's always championed new works here that have told new stories. And that's important. And that's the kind of work that we're also doing at the foundation. So, yes, thank you for drawing that parallel.
Well, you're welcome. Mary Cardwell Dawson, her story is new to most people, but it's an old story because she started this work a long, long time ago. And because she was relatively unknown and kind of forgotten by many people or have never known by many people, I'm curious how you found out about her.
So thank you. I'm on faculty at the Juilliard School and also at the Peabody Conservatory. And I do a fair amount of master classes all around the United States. And there was a young woman that I had been working with a few times. And this was just before the pandemic broke. I saw her outside of what was formerly known as the National Negro Opera Company. This was in the winter of 2019. And she was singing on the staircase in the snow and talking about this and at a building that was clearly very dilapidated, you know, run down, you know, the roof had collapsed, the columns had collapsed, the windows were torn out. And she talked about this great monument and how it had fallen into tremendous disrepair created by this woman, Mary Cardwell Dawson. And so I got in touch with her and I said, what is that that you're doing and who is this woman? And so when I started learning more about her, I told my students at the conservatory, because this was, by that time, we had really sort of gotten into the pandemic. And I told, and people were home and were available, I asked my students, I said, listen, I want you to sing an aria, to upload an aria online with the hashtag Save the National Opera House. And I want us to raise awareness around this and funds to help restore this great American monument. So that's how it started. It started like that, and my students were doing all this work, and people were getting in touch with me saying, "What is this that you're doing?" Now, simultaneously, I had started an online cooking show called Cooking with Denise. You'll have to check it out. There are lots of the episodes on YouTube. And so, as I was, and so this was a lifestyle show that was, it had me in the kitchen speaking with other artists and people in the industry in their kitchens, talking about life, talking about what's going on in the world today. Usually centered around art because we were all, whole world was on pause. We all had to eat. And so it was basically bringing cameras into people's homes and talking to them. We were talking during the cooking show about this woman. And I kept saying, and also this was live. This was being done live on live stream. I mean, sorry, StreamYard. And so, you know, we were talking about this woman. Have you all heard about this woman, Mary Carlota? And there were lots of people in the chat, you know, saying, "Oh, I knew about her," or "I didn't know about her," or "Tell me more." And so, between the work that we were doing with the students uploading their arias, with Seth raising awareness around Mary Cardwell Dawson, doing the cooking show, it garnered a lot of attention. We had over 250,000 viewers watching the cooking show. And so we had quite the, you know, the platform and the amplifier. And then Francesca Zambello, who's the artistic director of Washington National Opera, said, "Denise, I've got an idea. Why don't we have an opera or one woman show created around this great woman?" And I said, "Wow, that's amazing. Sure, let's do that." And so while what had originally been sort of me wanting to bring awareness and a project to my students, and also doing this online cooking show, before I knew it, the foundation had created itself, really. It was not my original intention, but that's where it gave birth to itself.
We're going to talk a lot about Mary Cardwell Dawson. We're going to talk about this one-woman show, which is actually a three-person or four-person show, and it's fundamentally you at the helm of all of it in a moment or two. But I want to talk about how she nurtured young black artists, trained them, employed them. You do a lot of the same things as you teach, as you said, and you've devoted yourself to helping young, underrepresented, marginalized artists find their way through this professional world of music. I would hope that the doors today are more open and more easily pushed open than they were back in 1941 for black artists, but maybe not. Is it still a struggle for non-white performers to make it in your world, in the world of opera?
First of all, you don't realize this, but you quoted a line from the play. You
Okay.
just quoted a line that was from the play, so that was great. So you'll have to come see it. Talking about pushing the door open. First of all, I would like to say that the Denise Grace Foundation is interested in talent. We're interested in excellence. We're interested in those great individuals who have a passion and have the talent to make a career in the classical vocal arts. So that's the first thing. So we're not. While a lot of the work that we do with, so we have three different programs, and the Hidden Voices program, because a lot of the hidden figures have been African American, the organization isn't solely an African American organization. So I do want to be clear about that. What we do is we go out of the mainstream and we find great talent, and we find those, again, those artists who are supremely gifted, who are passionate about this, and we help shape that career. And in that way, we sort of are modeled after the work of an impresaria, as Mary Cardwell Dawson was in nurturing talent of that time. So there's that great parallel. But I'm not sure. Did that answer your question? I'm not sure that it did.
Well, I just do you think in her
Oh,
time
that
it
it's
was
as difficult
well,
today.
but well, as long as we're talking about that, in her time it was incredibly difficult, and we'll talk about how she segued from wanting to be on the stage to being somebody who helped others get on the stage to you, because you came up at a time when I'm sure that there weren't as many African American or other ethnic voices on represented in opera, in the world of opera. Has it improved? Is it easier today than it was for you, than it was for her?
It has improved. It is a different world. It is a very, very different landscape than it was from when I started, and certainly at the time of Mary Caldwell Dawson, obviously. I will say the pathway itself, no matter who you are, is one that will test you. It's a challenging
Yes.
one, no matter who you are, right? So you've got to have the grit and the stamina and the heart, the perseverance for this road in the first place.
Right.
But certainly in the time of Mary Caldwell Dawson, you know, she wanted to be an opera singer and wanted to make a name for herself on the world's great stages. And in 1925, you know, when she graduated the New England Conservatory, the apartheid at that time made that nearly impossible. And her response to that was, well, then, okay, I'll create my own opera house. And I love that about her. I just love that kind of ingenuity. I love that kind of spirit. And she did that. And so while she did not have the career that perhaps she wanted, I think her calling was much greater. And she helped launch the careers of so many others and gave a real opportunity and platform for African American artists, not just singers, but you know, instrumentalists, composers, directors, designers, all of that. And so she had a much greater impact than perhaps maybe she would have had as a solo artist. So her karma was an important one.
And you are giving her due through what you're doing with the foundation and with this play. But there were so many others along the way who were in the same position. And one of the things that you have discovered through your foundation is a lot of these other undiscovered, unknown, talented people who simply did not have the opportunities they might have today. And
So
one of the
many.
people, yeah, well, one of the people that is mentioned on your website, and this just leapt off the screen at me yesterday, is a woman who lived from 1809 to 1896. Elizabeth Taylor, what a great name.
Greenfield.
Yeah, Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield, one of the first publicly acclaimed professional African American classical musicians in the country. And she went from being an enslaved woman to playing a command performance for Queen Victoria at Buckingham Palace.
Isn't it
Wow.
fabulous? Isn't it fabulous? Isn't it fabulous? And not just her, but we, you know, we've uncovered already 136, 136 that have been, you know, been in the game and been part of the whole musical fabric, classical music industry, the refined arts in the 16, 1700s, 1800s, you know, Ciceretta Jones, you know, Marisa Laika Williams. If you go to our website, we have a whole hidden figures or hidden voices vertical that will talk about those. And we've got calendars that we've done for the past 3 years, where each month we highlight a hidden figure, a hidden voice, and we talk about them and their biography. And there are lots of different things that we do in addition to that. But yes, Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield was another one. And there's so many others. You know, we just saw that Searchlight last year did the film of Chevalier Saint-Georges, right? Which they call Chevalier, who was a contemporary. Well, we're going to say he was a contemporary of Mozart, but actually he lived 80 years before Mozart, right? And was this incredible, incredible musician. And now, in this period of inclusion and belonging that we find ourselves in, and I hope will be systemic and not topical, we see a lot of the works being performed. You know, I know that Yannick at the Metropolitan Opera did a big thing about Florence Price, and where he did a lot of her works.
I hope you're enjoying this conversation with opera star Denise Graves. We're listening to a series this week of my favorite conversations of 2024, and this conversation continues right after this. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. This week, we are listening back to a series of my favorite conversations of 2024. And in fact, when we had this conversation with opera star Denise Graves back in February, I made a note of the fact that this was a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to her, hearing about her career, and about Mary Cardwell Dawson, which is the subject of this conversation and why she came to Charlotte in the first place. Not many people know about her, so I asked her to tell us about her because she is a North Carolina native.
How about that? I love that. And I love being in her home state. That's right, a very, very talented woman. She grew up in Madison, North Carolina, and went to the New England Conservatory. Was involved in music as a young child, and found her way to the conservatory. Graduated in 1925, as I said, with a degree in voice and piano. And she was the only African American in her class. And she wanted to go out into the world and share her talents. But she shared them differently, and she became a much more important figure, I think, than perhaps if she had just had a solo career. You know, she created, she established the Mary Cardwell Dawson Choir with the 500 voices. In 1935 and 1937, she won all kinds of national awards. She was president of the National Association of Negro Musicians, and from 1940 to 1942. She established, of course, the National Negro Opera Company, which opened in which operated until 1962. And she brought them all over the United States, including the Metropolitan Opera, at a time when there were no African-American artists at the Metropolitan Opera at Carnegie Hall. She brought them there. It was the first time that the Metropolitan Opera had allowed an independent opera company to rent the space, so they rented the space. And then the union would not allow them to perform standard repertoire. So they performed a piece by an African-American violinist and composer, Clarence Cameron White, and a piece called Wanga. And of course, it was to great acclaim. And she took them to Carnegie Hall and had great, great success. And she had chapters in Chicago, in Detroit, Washington, D.C., where she lived, New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, and of course, Pittsburgh, where the National Negro Opera Company is. Right. And it was not just this opera company. So it's this old Victorian house. And on the third floor, they would rehearse. One of the difficult things which you will see in the play is her trying to find venues that would allow an all-Black opera company to come perform. But also on the second floor, she had a music school, and she taught some over 600 students music, and she taught piano, and she taught voice, and she taught languages, and she taught stage direction. But it was also an access house. So this was during the time of Jim Crow. So when jazz greats like Duke Ellington, Lena Horne, Cab Calloway, Pearl Bailey, all those guys, even sports figures like Roberto Clemente were passing through Pittsburgh, they could not stay at the hotels. So they would stay at the opera house. Mm. And this was a great, great, great woman. And her husband also, who is sort of an unsung hero, who is a master electrician, but all of the work that he did went back into the company to help support the work that she was doing.
I want you to back up for a second, because you were talking about how her company was the first company allowed to rent the Met, the Metropolitan Opera, for a performance. But while they were in that theater, they were not permitted to do the standard repertoire. Was that because it was an African-American company, or was it because the Met just wouldn't let anybody do that on their stage because that's what they do?
Well, it was coming from the union at that time, and they wouldn't allow them to do that. Now, the reasons behind it, I don't know. There's all sorts of speculation as to why they did not allow that. Perhaps they didn't view them on equal footing as, you know, what they were doing with the houses, or they didn't want that comparison. Or they didn't want people to say that they were great or better. Who knows what the reasoning was, but they were not allowed to do that in that. There were certain conditions. I mean, when they came and they rented the Metropolitan Opera House, they had to bring their own box office. They had to bring their own, you know, costumes and everything. They just actually rented the space. So I think that they didn't want any comparison. They wanted to be able to see this organization as something separate.
When she was running the National Negro Opera Company in 1941, I think she opened it in 1941, and this play is set 2 years later in 1943. How large a pool of talent did she have to draw from? Because the opportunities were so limited, how did she find these people? How did they find their way to opera?
Over 1,600 singers when she
Holy
first opened,
smokes.
she found. Right. And so I think exactly. And I love your reaction because this is the reaction that I had too in learning about her and learning about so many other wonderful, wonderful figures. People think that they didn't exist. They did exist. They were there the whole time, but they were not given an opportunity, right? And that's what she did. She created this stage for all kinds of artists. She found hundreds and hundreds. Right away, 1,600 right away of classically trained African American artists, whether they were instrumentalists or singers, they existed, right? And this is what has been left out of the telling of the story. And that's part of the work that we're doing is getting that education in K through 12, in getting that through the collegiate level, through our Shared Voices program. So we have three programs. We have Hidden Voices, which is the program that we're talking about now, Shared Voices program, which is an HBCU conservatory exchange, and Generational Voices, which is our young emerging artist program. And all of these things are modeled after Mary Caldwell Dawson and what it was that she did in her life.
As you mentioned, she wanted to be an a professional opera singer, and her opportunities were limited because of the time in which she lived, Jim Crow and segregation, etc. And that was throughout the country. That wasn't just in the South, as this play points out, because the play takes place in Washington, D.C.,
That's
and we'll
right.
talk about that in a second. But since she realized early in her career that she couldn't do what she wanted to do on the stage because of limitations put on her and others like her by society, what made her think that she could start an opera company and put them on the stage?
Wonderful. Isn't it fabulous? The audacity. Isn't it fantastic? And I just love that about her spirit. And I think we'll see that in the play that she was really fearless. She was really she was determined. She was had a conviction, and she believed that she and those like her had something to offer to the world, and she wanted them to have that opportunity. And so she felt, yeah, there was mountain get out of my way. She wanted to bring this to the people. And she believed, like we believe at the Denise Graves Foundation, that there should be no barriers around excellence and around art and around talent, right? That is something that should be shared. And so absolutely, she just marched forward. And Sister Retta Jones sort of did the same thing, just believed that what they had was an important God-given gift that they wanted to share with the world.
And what we have to remember, I think, is that she was, I don't want to say pushy, but she was f fearless and strong and forceful at a time when women weren't. They weren't allowed to be. And certainly not black women.
Some of
How
the things
did she do it?
she did was really remarkable. I mean, and is well noted. I mean, she would get she and we talk about this in a little bit in the play. One of the there was a story that happened when she was in a store, just browsing and looking, wanted to buy a new hat, and she touched this hat, and there was a lot of surprise and astonishment about this woman who touched this hat and how the sales clerk was sort of trailing her, demanding that she buy it because she touched it. And the fight that broke out, and the same thing that happened with the union, was she would get in physical fights with people. I mean, she was really a spitfire. I mean, she was scrappy, and even slapped a white man at that time, where that could be the end of your life, right?
Yeah.
She was really, really a tempest in a teapot. I mean, she was tiny, like tiny little thing.
She was gutsy, and she sounds a little bit like how Morley Safer described you when he profiled you for 60 Minutes several years ago. He described you as someone who has guts, talent, and beauty, who who, with the help of your mother and your teacher, pulled yourself out of a despairing inner-city neighborhood to stride the world stages as though you owned them. And here's how he began that conversation on CBS.
Do you know what I find remarkable? I have to tell you this.
Tell me.
That you let us in here minutes before you're going on to make your Metropolitan Opera House debut.
Oh, God, now I just got nervous.
Well, no, you didn't get nervous. You've got to have ice cubes in your veins.
On the opposite, I feel really hot on the inside, and I'm trying to stay as calm as possible. I mean, I have to. I can't afford to let myself be excited.
Now, I want to remind folks that this is moments before the curtain went up on your Metropolitan Opera debut. Ethel Merman, I'm going to misquote her here, but she once was asked before the curtain rose on a new show, are you nervous? And she said, no, I know my lines, I know my songs, I know my dances, let's go. is that how you approach performing?
No, not at all, not at all.
How did you let him in then? This is a big night for you. This is a big deal.
It was a big night. You know, first of all, I remember that moment, but I was just marveling now about how high my voice was. I can tell that I had been warming up. Since that time, my voice has dropped probably a couple of octaves. So that was the first thing that I found astonishing. But I think that, you know, at that point, we were well rehearsed. I was super excited. I knew something was happening important. You know, my mother that evening had organized a bus trip, and she brought over 200 people from Washington, D.C. to come see that. And I know that, like Mary Cardwell Dawson, that moment was bigger than me, right? It was bigger than about what I was feeling.
Well, let me ask you about that, because that parallels something that happens in the play. You mentioned that your mother brought busloads of people to New York from Washington to see your debut at the Metropolitan Opera. And one of the things in the play, they're supposed to open this opera that she is producing at the Watergate, which we'll talk about in a second. Not the Watergate we all know, but the Watergate Amphitheater that used to be at the foot of the Memorial Bridge in Washington. And it's the weather is bad, and they're searching for a new venue, and the venues are segregated, and many members of the cast in this play are concerned that if they put it inside, their family cannot come and see it. Did that idea happen in her lifetime, or is that your story interpolated into hers?
That story for Mary Cardwell Dawson absolutely happened in her lifetime, and she refused. She refused. I mean, she could have performed in some inside venues, but then Black people weren't allowed to be there. And so she fought that. So that was absolutely paramount to her, because that's what she wanted to do. I mean, look at the surprise that we talked about just now in doing the show, and about, you know, your discovery of Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield and knowing that, oh my goodness, or Chevalier Saint-Georges, that there were these, you know, or Blind Tom, or all these wonderful, wonderful classical Black artists that existed back in the 1700s, 1800s that we didn't know anything about. So that kind of astonishment. And so she was wanting to say that, because I think that, okay, now we're going to get into something, we're going to get into something a little sticky. I think that when you talk about African-American artists are well known for being creative and certainly musical, and where gospel is concerned and where jazz is concerned and R&B, but you don't necessarily think or see a face like mine when you think of the refined arts. And I think that's really, really an important point, because we're talking about something that's supposed to be, particularly where opera is concerned, which is an amalgamation of all of the refined arts. When you think of the way that African-Americans have been portrayed in society, it's not in a refined way. It's not in an elegant way, right? I'm not saying that gospel music or jazz or all of that stuff can't be refined. I think it's tremendously gorgeous. Gospel music for me is the music that has informed my music making. It's where I got my start. So I understand that. But I'm just talking about in society, when you start talking about the finer things of life, you don't necessarily think or African Americans have not been portrayed, have not been seen in that realm.
Which gets back to why it was important that your mother bring these busloads of people to your debut, why it's important for these actors in this Mary Dawson production that they be able to have their families there to see them, A, in a light that nobody else has ever seen them in, to show that they are equal to, better than, or belong with the rest of them. And also, I think, to expose people who would not otherwise be exposed to that music, because God knows how many potentially talented people there are out there who've never heard this, never seen it, don't know anything about it, and therefore don't pursue it.
Mike, I want to thank you. I can tell you I can cry right now. I just want to thank you so much for doing this story. I want to thank you for bringing this to your audiences. I know that this, you have a very, very wide viewership. This is such an important conversation because, you know, when we were here, I've been here before with the Margaret Garner story. Mm-hmm. And that was another sort of lost story out of all the sort of the slave antebellum stories. That was one that fell into also into obscurity, right? And that was an important story, too, because it was sort of the modern day Medea story. And what was important about that trial is that if she would be tried for destruction of property or murder, and if it were murder, that meant that she had to be considered to be a human being. And so when we talk about Mary Cardwell Dawson's story, when we talk about showing African-Americans or underrepresented people in the classical refined arts, and the reason that the Metropolitan or the union at the time did not want the National Negro Opera Company to perform standard repertoire, because then there would be a comparison, right? Then you'd have to acknowledge that in fact we are more alike than unalike. And that's what's important. And that's the healing that I think we all want to see happen in our nation and also in the world. Something happened during the pandemic where we were watching all of these things unfold. And now, we, as I said earlier, we want to believe that this is something that's going to be systemic and not topical, right? This period of awakening and this period of inclusion, right? That's important. We all sort of seem to make the decision that this is not the country that we wanted to create. We wanted to create a country that was more unified.
We're talking to opera star Denise Graves, who has been in Charlotte many times, but joined us in February to talk about Mary Cardwell Dawson and her playing the title role in The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson, a woman largely credited for changing the face of opera and bringing a lot of African-American performers into the field. That conversation continues right after this. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and this week we are listening back to some of my favorite conversations of 2024. No joke, every show this week is one of my favorite conversations. This is certainly one of them, with opera star Denise Graves, who is in town in February to perform the title role in The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson. We're going to hear more about Mary Cardwell Dawson, a remarkable woman for her time, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't hear a little bit of opera star Denise Graves herself in Carmen.
Jamais connu des lois, si tu ne m'aimes pas.
Denise Graves, who I should say, got up and walked away and got a bottle of water during that performance. And that's a recurring theme on this program. If I play pieces of music that people have performed and they are a guest on the show, they don't want to hear it.
That's true. It's true.
One of the reasons that this production, The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson, came to be was obviously to let people know about this remarkable woman and to explore the obstacles that would have stopped most people dead in their tracks, which did not stop her. She pushed through. This is not revisionist history, but it will revise a lot of what people think they know about that time in our country. Is this something that older people need to be reminded of to refresh their memories of how far we've come, or something that younger people need to learn so they can appreciate the achievements of those who came before, but also recognize that the journey isn't over?
Both in both directions, old and young alike, for sure. Yes, she was completely undeterred in her determination to bring this to people. But, you know, so much has been lost in our history in general. You know, I said to you earlier that you were talking about the Morley Safer interview and about allowing him to speak for us to have a conversation just before I stepped foot on the stage. Because I realized how very important that moment was. You know, I lost my father last year, and he didn't know when his birthday was. Like, we didn't know, because at the time, he was not allowed to go. His parents weren't allowed to go to the hospital, so they had him at home, and it was done by a midwife, and so nobody kept records, right, of exactly the date. And it's that close. It's that close. So it's not that long ago.
Right.
And yes, there has been tremendous progress, and I'm so proud of that, and so proud to be coming along in this time. But I do feel a tremendous amount of responsibility and excitement in being able to tell this woman's story and to be able to share this part of history. When we looked for Mary Cardwell, one of the other things that I'm supremely proud of is that when we started this, if you Googled Mary Cardwell Dawson, there was one entry, and now there are over 17,000.
Oh, wow.
And I am enormously proud of the work that's been done and we've been putting out there, and that's been shared about who she is. And, you know, if you looked for her in that time, it wasn't that she wasn't covered in mainstream, but a lot of the Black dailies, you know, had documented her work that was being done in churches and in around the communities. So I guess that what's happening now is bringing her story more to mainstream.
This The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson is not an opera. It is a play with music, and it was commissioned by the Glimmerglass Festival in Cooperstown, New York, which everybody knows as the Baseball Hall of Fame city.
That's right.
About 3 years ago, you played the title role in that first production. You played the title role in a production that was staged at the Kennedy Center not too long ago in D.C., and now you're playing Mary Cardwell Dawson again here in Charlotte. Has anyone else ever played this role before? Are you
yes.
In? Okay.
Well, thank you for saying. And we've talked about that. We've had that discussion with some of the creators, you know, Francesca Zambello. It's always important particularly now post-COVID, I think that whenever you have a new work that's, you know, not Bohème or Carmen or something like that, that a lot of people would know that you need to have other artists who know the work, because things happen. People get sick. And actually, Glimmerglass did it in two summers, and then my daughter ended up in the hospital and had to have surgery, and so I had to leave that production. And there was a beautiful woman, Allison, oh gosh, I don't remember her last name, but who has done the role, and so she knows it. And so it leaves here. It's going to go to Pittsburgh, it's going to go to Atlanta, and I think she will be sharing those performances. So that's really, really wonderful.
So let me ask you some technical stuff, because you're an opera singer. You're a performer. Opera singers are actors, but it's a different world. And this is a play where not everything is sung. There are lines. In fact, you have most of the lines in this play. And I know that opera has changed in recent years. It's not just park and bark, stand and sing. It is it is movement around, and you have to act. But when you take the music away from an opera singer and put her on a stage, and she has to hold that stage. What does that feel like? Does it feel like somebody's taken one of your appendages away?
Now, isn't that something? Now, you have hit on something very, very important. You have hit on something super important because it is an emotional work. Also, it does require, you know, normally we sing better than we speak. And it, what I mean by that is that when we are singing, we're thinking about technique, right? And we have to, because, you know, we're thinking about how we place that and connecting all of the different registers. But when we speak, you know, we're not thinking about that in that way. I mean, I think that if you listen to interviews with some of the golden age divas, you know, if you listen to Leontine Price and Jesse Norman, they were always speaking in their head was, oh, hello, good morning. Hi, how are you? Lovely to see you. And at first, when you hear that, you say like, oh, please, come on, give me a break. But what they were doing was vocalizing, and they were keeping their speaking voices in line with their singing voices. I should have done much more of that. I should have done much more of that because I speak a lot of times on my chords, right? And so that's used, you know, if you think about a violinist is not playing the violin from the moment they wake up in the morning until the moment they go to bed. But we're using our voices from the moment we wake all day long, and not in the most healthy way. Yeah. When I was a student, I went to New England Conservatory, also like Mary Caldwell Dawson, but before that to Oberlin College. And I had my second voice lesson with my voice teacher. And she said, Denise, your voice doesn't sound the way it did the very first lesson. What is going on? What did you do last night? And I said, oh, I was out with friends laughing. And she said, you were laughing on the night before a voice lesson? So I'm saying that to say that we use a lot of the principle of the instrument and talking and laughing and eating and all of those different things that you don't think about that cost you vocally.
Yeah.
So there's a great cost vocally, you know, to having to perform and because so much of the part of Mary Caldwell Dawson is spoken and so much of it is emotional, right? Much of that has to be projected. So there is a great vocal cost, yes.
And I was going to ask you about that because in musicals, in opera, when the emotions rise, it's usually in a song because it's easier to do it. It's more difficult to produce it, but easier for the audience to feel that emotion through the music. And this play opens with the monologue with you on the phone. We don't hear the other end of the conversation. It all has to come through you, but it's also an emotional conversation. And she has these emotional moments throughout this play. Do you as a singer wish, gee, I wish they put this in a song?
Yes.
why didn't they?
I would have much preferred to have sung it. Because it would have made that easier in a lot of ways. It's a real challenge to speak and sing. That's a great, great, great challenge because of the way that we do it. And because of the nature of this particular work, but it's difficult anyway, because we sing in a very different place from where we speak. Unless you want to put everything up in the head voice, and it's early in the morning, and unless you want to place everything up, then it can sound contrived and not natural and not what we want and not where, you know, and I have a low voice anyway, and I've got a low speaking voice anyway. And then you add the emotion to that. And also the fact that for me, it is a real personal story. You know, this is a story that I understand. You know, I didn't have to go to a coaching for this. I understand this woman. I understand this, the circumstances. It hits me in my core. Because it is a story of that I know of my people, of my life.
And what you yourself went through. I mean, you told Morley Safer about your childhood.
Absolutely.
And had it not been for your mother instilling in you that you were special and that you were a child of God and that that you would not have gone through this. You needed people to help you, to push you along the way.
Thank you for that homework, Mike. Thank you for that background study on that. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. Look, it's my job.
Yeah,
well, but thank you.
Yeah, it's not everybody who comes to the party with that kind of an awareness and work having been done, but it's so evident. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing it. You share the stage with three other characters, three other actors, three other vocalists, singers in Dawson's production. I think they're rehearsing Carmen for a production at, everybody knows the Watergate is the hotel where the scandal took place. But before it was that, it was a barge on the Potomac with steps leading up from the barge to the Lincoln Memorial. I grew up in D.C., so I remember this.
Oh, yeah. You do?
Yeah, I'm old, Denise. when I was younger, they were still having concerts at the barge on the Potomac, at the Watergate barge. And they stopped it because of the jet traffic that goes down the Potomac to National Airport. It would drown out anything that was on the stage, and it happened every 10 minutes or less.
Right.
So they hauled the barge away, and the steps are still there, but no concerts take place. Anyway, they're trying to stage this at the barge in this production, she's prodding them throughout this production, bringing them to life, directing them, giving them character motivation, explaining why they have to be such a way when they're playing these various roles. But as I read the play yesterday, as I read it, I thought this must be very difficult to play because a lot of different things are happening subtextually and on the stage at the same time.
Absolutely. It 100% is a great, great and very, very different challenge, you know. But I am grateful to Francesca Zambello. I have to say that. I mean, I have to say that because Francesca had the insight and she said, Denise, I've got an idea and let's do it. And so often in the profession, you know, people come to you with projects and ideas that they have and more likely than not, they don't see the light of day. You know, and this is something that that she actually saw through, and so I'm so excited about that, to have been working with her on that from its inception.
So there are moments in the play when we hear the other vocalists sing pieces from Carmen,
right?
And at the end of the play, there is an original piece that I believe you sing. Is that correct?
So there are a few original pieces by Carlos Simon. There's one called "Divided Soul." There's another piece that he arranged, and then there's the one that you're referring to is called She Steps Onto a Floating Stage. So those are the pieces that Carlos Simon set to Sandra Seton's words. But yes, she is, the night before was supposed to have been a performance of La Traviata, starring the great Lilian Avanti, but that was rained out. And then this night is supposed to be Carmen, and so she coaches these young artists, you know, through some of the important and highlights of the opera. And so we get an opportunity to see that. And fortunately for me, that's a role that I've had a great walk with. And so it's very natural and also really exciting, too, to see the next generation of artists coming up who are portraying those great characters.
I have a minute left. I have a thousand more questions, but I'll have to limit them to one, I think. During its run at the Kennedy Center, the Washington Post wrote, "The best parts of The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson are when the lines blur between its subject and its star, mezzo-soprano Denise Graves." Do you understand that comment?
So first of all, thank you for sharing that, because I never read anything. I don't read reviews. I don't read them at all. It's the first time that I'm hearing that. That's really beautiful. I'm very, very, very touched by that. I had not seen myself in the way that this reviewer described, in the way that you have sort of characterized it this morning. I have seen my role very differently in that, you know, I want to sort of highlight and bring to life what the work that she's doing, but I had never seen it sort of in comparison to my own life.
Opera star Denise Graves with us back in February to talk about her playing the title role in The Passion of Mary Cardwell Dawson with Opera Carolina. Remarkable, two remarkable women, and that's why this conversation is part of this week of my favorite conversations of 2024. I hope you enjoyed it. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.